Accession number 30633, Mr. James Farquharson, Reel 3. Now, we're talking about your time at Harrow from 1933 onwards in quite some detail, and we're looking at punishments. You said there was no flogging or corporal punishment except for one sort, mostly, you said. Well,
yes, I can't be sure that there wasn't some corporal punishment in other houses, but I'm fairly confident that there were few and far between, if at all. But there was, at the top of the school, a club, you might call it, called the Philathletic Club. There was a similar thing at Eton called POP, you may have heard of. Very senior boys who tended to dress in fancy bow ties and all sorts of things and really make much of themselves, and were responsible for all regulations about dress on the cricket field and the football field and things like that. And there were rules that only if you were in the school cricket 11, we were allowed to wear white shoes for cricket, I think, and everybody else wore brown shoes. And I remember one character, he was called Haim, H-A-Y-I-M, who was a bit of a rebel, and he, out of bravado, I think, appeared on the cricket field in white shoes. And he had a Phil beating, which was, I don't know, it was six of the best or something. But that's about the only occasion, I think, when there was a formal flogging that I've ever heard of. But certainly there would have been other occasions, and probably all perpetrated by members of the Phil, with their special authority, in a very limited field.
And they'd use the cane?
They used a cane, yeah, as far as I know, yes.
But the masters didn't?
The masters didn't use a cane at all, nothing like that. And this now was very much frowned on. I mean, the school prided itself on not having normal corporal punishment.
Now, so after prep, would you go straight to bed, or was there a period?
You go straight to bed, because lights were turned out at the main at 10 o'clock, and only the privs, I suppose their rooms, which were always the same, were on a different circuit, because privs were allowed to keep their lights on after 10 o'clock, put them out when they were ready.
So it wasn't a matter of choice, the lights just went off?
They just went off, that was it.
Now, what did you? How did you get on with the rest of the boys? I mean, was it a, you know, did you make a lot of really good friends there?
I made a certain number of very good friends, yes. And there were a certain number of boys generally frowned upon for one reason or another. I can remember one fellow whose death I read in the paper quite lately, in fact, stole my. It's a trivial little thing. He stole my clothes brush, which was lying, I suppose, on my chest of drawers. It disappeared, and I was slightly suspicious. And when he was out, I went into his room, and there was my clothes brush standing on his chest of drawers. And I accused him of stealing it. He said, "Absolute rubbish, that's mine." And by very lucky chance, I was able to prove it was mine, because it had a sort of varnished surface to the brush, and there were very slight indentations in it where my initials had originally been painted and had entirely faded out. And by holding it to the light at the right angle, you could see it had JJF on the top. And I don't think this was made into a formal business at all. I think he then realised he was caught, and that was that. And I said,
"So you didn't report it to the privs or to the masters?"
No, I can't really remember anybody being... Oh, yes, there was a fellow called Howroyd, who... I can't remember what he did now, but he was... I'm not sure that he wasn't beaten, actually. It was fairly early in my time, but I couldn't say any more about that. I just don't remember, except the vague
but
recollection.
Stealing was not common, I would imagine.
No, it wasn't common. There was a certain amount of dishonesty and trying to foist what you ought to be doing onto somebody else. I mean, things of fagging and things like that.
So there was it was a usual school life. You made some very good friends, and you made some enemies.
Yes, yes.
It's nice to think of you not liking this bloke about the brush for the rest of his life. But What about the Masters? Can you talk a bit about their qualities or otherwise, as far as you say? I suspect a lot of them would have been First World War veterans or around about that age.
Yes, though I must say we heard very little about that. To hark back for a moment to my prep school, Langton Travers, one of the Masters I remember, he was called Lacey Mayo, Major Mayo, and he was employed by the school on some special government scheme for placing retired officers who had, I don't know how they were chosen, but he came as a master and was quite good. He even wrote a school play, I remember. George Lacey Mayo, that was his name. He was always treated as slightly as a joke by the boys. He was rather more military than the others, and his nickname was Bulawayo. That's by the side. I mean,
now, what
digress.
Were the Masters like generally at Harrow? And what did you think of them as a bunch? It's a wrong
as
word,
a bunch, they had very strong characters. There were some were Masters of very long standing who had they introduced, I suppose, early in my time, a rule that housemasters could only serve as housemasters for 15 years. And then they either retired or reverted to being an ordinary undermaster. Of course, some of them moved on to appointments in other schools and things like that. And in general, I think they were fairly carefully chosen. There were one or two rather dud masters, I thought.
Now, what made a dud master for you? I mean, what was, you know...
A dud master was one who, I think, probably much in common with all other schools, was dull and a bad disciplinarian. I can't explain exactly how, but he didn't command respect. I think that was a way of summing it up. There were others who were respected perhaps because of their position in the school, that they were looked upon as permanent institutions almost. And there were others who had written well-known collaborated usually in writing a well-known textbook, Siddons and Hughes, North and Hillard, various names like that ring a bell. Siddons and Hughes must have been mathematics of some sort, and that was a book of that kind, I suppose, for geometry and algebra. And we even started in my time, golly, I can't remember what they... name of the process was, but an advanced form of mathematics, logarithms.
Now, was there one or two masters that particularly influenced you? You know, you said there was often one, you know, that stood out.
That's perfectly true, and that I remember particularly in my senior days. After taking the school certificate, in which I did extremely well, actually, I rather faded away after that. I was no longer as bright, I think. But I got an extraordinarily small amount of advice as to what was the right thing to do.
Let's follow that. I'll come back to OTC. Your school certificate, was you took at 16, was it?
Depended how at what level you joined the school. I went in what's called Shell 1A. Now, there was a fourth form at the bottom. And these forms were, if you call it streamed in these days, but there were levels. I mean, the shells were, there was Shell Classical, Shell 1A, Shell 1B, Shell 2, Shell 3, I think, and according to your abilities. So you were put into the appropriate one of those. And I was... in those days, I was always in the top one. And in fact, halfway through my first term, my form master called me over and said, "Now you're wasting your time here. You're getting a send-up." A send-up was what the master, if you did good work, the master put sent up for good. And you then presented that to your housemaster. And if you collected enough of them in the appropriate time, you got a prize. And he said, "You're getting send-ups all the time. This is just... you're wasting your time here. I'm going to speak to the headmaster and recommend that we move you up to the remove," which was the next level. And so by the end of my first term, I was three levels up from the bottom. And in the autumn of my first year, I went there in January. By September, I was in the lower fifths, which was the level at which you read for the school certificate. And so by the age of 15, I took the school certificate, and some people didn't take it till 17. And I passed through that, so that I had a
now
long...
What subjects did you do at the school certificate? I mean...
I did.
Did you concentrate on anything, or was it ward?
No, you did a range of set subjects. Elementary maths, additional maths, and I think that incorporated geometry and algebra anyhow. Latin, English, geography, history, I think divinity even.
And you pass all of these, even history you didn't like.
I failed in history, I think. I got, there were seven subjects. I got six credits, which were top marks, and one fail, and that was history. And that entitled me to go straight into the upper fifth, which was the level below the sixth. So that I had three more years in which to move about in higher circles, in fact. And that's where things went badly wrong, because nobody, as far as I can remember, gave me any advice about what to specialise in, and you then specialised. And I decided I'd like to do maths. And I found, to my cost, very quickly, I was in the maths upper fifth for a whole year, under a master called Morris, he was one of the ones I thought was a bit of a dud. And I simply couldn't understand, make head or tail of what he was teaching us, because suddenly there were no more figures, no more numbers. It was all letters and hieroglyphics of various sorts.
Algebra and formulas.
Yes, what did I call it? Logarithms and something beyond that. Something called de Moivre's theorem, among other things. I never knew or understood what on earth that was, except for the name. So, at the end of that year, I begged to be excused from maths, and I went into modern languages and started specialising in French and beginning to learn German.
And did that go better?
That went better, particularly in French. Now, at that stage, I began to realise how good some of the masters were. And I had...
Now, this is how we got on to this, yeah.
Yes,
so who
yes.
was...
There was the man who taught me French in the upper fifth, yes, he was called A.G. Elliot Smith. Very affected man. He was the nephew of a famous archaeologist, I think, called Sir Grafton Elliot Smith, who went digging around in Egypt or somewhere. And anyhow, Elliot Smith was a very unusual master. For instance, when we went to him for early school, the classroom had little balconies, little French windows opening onto balconies. And the first thing he made us do was to go out on the balcony and take deep breaths. And then we did phonetic exercises, saying or something, or other, all the different vowel sounds in French. And he was always entertaining and kept us interested. Then when I went up into the sixth form, there was an equally amusing man who insisted on calling the form the club, I remember, and we all were given ranks in the club. The first year, I was the purity campaigner, and there was a club secretary, and there were all sorts of other appointments, and he was a retired sailor, Lieutenant Commander Gannon, E.D. Gannon, with a black beard, and he used to appear at the beginning of the class, sweep into the room, take off his gown, twirl it round, put it down on the dais, and his little black Aberdeen Terrier would come trotting in through the door, called Shock, would climb up and settle down and sleep in the wrapped-up gown for the whole class. And he must have been half French, because he really, he was as good as a Frenchman, he had a house on La Rochelle or somewhere, and he was right up to date with French slang, and he used to teach us masses of colloquial French. And one of the things that amused us was that he would, I remember particularly a fairly racy novel by A.E.W. Mason, and we all had to buy a copy of that. And then in turn, he went round the class, and we took it in turns to pick up the story and read it straight out in French from the English text, and of course get hopelessly tangled up. And that was the way in which he fed us with all these colloquialisms and modern slang and so on. It was enormous fun, and very, very useful for a time.
So you were enjoying this?
Enjoying that very much. By contrast, Harry Cooper, who was the German sixth form master, was a bit of a flop. He was a serious, dull chap who taught us in a pretty old-fashioned way. There was no sort of chit-chat at all, and we did the best we could and tended to mock the German language out of class. Words like Fussboden, which was the floor. One chap, I always called it Pussyfoot for some reason, and things like that. Oh, and in my final year, one of the masters was exchanged for a German master from, was it Zalim, the German public school based on an English one, a Hitlerite establishment. Herr Steiner, I think he was called, and he arrived at the time of the Munich crisis and started to teach us, and then the moment the crisis happened, he went off and packed his bag and was ready to go back to Germany, and it all blew over, and so he reappeared. And he was the subject of much mockery, I'm afraid. I always wondered what had happened to him. He was very military. I'm sure he was killed on the Russian front or something eventually. But that was the sort of thing. There were other exchanges with foreign schools as well, which were at least interesting. I don't know how much.
Now, what about the OTC? Was it called the Officers' Training Corps?
It was.
How did you join that? At what age were you allowed to?
I joined it in my third term. That's to say, the autumn of September 1934, when I'd been in the school two terms. I suppose it was something.
Was it optional? Because it wasn't optional.
No, it wasn't optional.
It was compulsory.
It was compulsory generally, but I suspect that if your parents objected or something, you could be excused, but you had no say in it yourself. And
now, what uniform were you given?
Our uniform consisted of an old field service uniform, I suppose, a tunic with brass buttons, buttoning up to the neck, and breeches, almost like riding breeches, down to below the knee, and then, I suppose, socks of some sort, boots, highly polished boots, black boots, and putties, which are wound round your calves, to your lower leg, up to the bottom of the trousers.
Did you have trouble with that? Get it? Because it is quite an art to get
them. It was a tremendous art, yes. Yes, there were many occasions when I kept on failing over and over again and had to do it three or four times before I got it right, probably. But one took great pride in getting it right, and also, of course, one was liable for punishment if you didn't do it properly.
So any other uniform that you were given?
Let me think. A cap, of course, a peaked cap.
So it's basically the standard British Army uniform before they brought in combat dress and the rest of it.
Yes. I mean, it's what troops wore in the First War, I think. Not battle dress came in, of course, very soon, just before the Second War, as far as I remember.
Now, when would you do your OTC training?
The OTC training was done on Wednesday afternoons. There was a big parade ground down on the among the football fields, and we had to parade there.
Who would take the OTC lessons? Who were you?
The OTC was organised into there was a Major E. J. Housden was the commander.
Housden. Housden.
Housden. Yes, Housden. Under him were, I think, several masters who had probably been serving in the war, as officers. There were a very limited number of boys who were promoted to under officer and wore a collar and tie and an open-fronted tunic. And then there were NCO instructors, and they were old sweats from the army. Two or three of them, I should say, who sort of conducted marching drill and things like that.
Now, what were these instructors like? Because normally they must have been seen as quite characters.
They were great characters. And I wish I could remember better now, the three, I think it was three, NCOs. One might even have been a warrant officer, but they were seemed to be very elderly to us then. That's my wife's alarm. But and NCOs were great characters, respected, but also enjoyed because of their language.
In what way?
Sometimes mispronunciations of malapropisms, sometimes ways of ticking you off using military language. I really can't quote details at the moment. I want to be able to. They come back sometimes.
Well, we'll carry. Now, tell me about the drill, sir. So every Wednesday afternoon, you'd be in this.
The drill, you know, it seems to me it was always marching drill.
How did you take
in
to
drill? Squads.
I mean, because it's not something you'd done before, I presume. I mean,
no, I enjoyed it. It was something so simple that if you took a little trouble and you kept your head about you and didn't go into a dream, so that when he said right turn, you were the only one who turned left and came face to face with somebody else, when you burst into fits of giggles and were probably put on a charge, were made to fall out and stand on the side. That happened to me even in the Royal Army when I was at OCTU. Generally speaking, there were, of course, boys who simply couldn't make head or tail of it, never get the sense of military discipline and were always in trouble. And others, it's just a matter of your temper and perhaps your, to some extent, your family background. I had an uncle who was a fairly distinguished soldier in the First World War, and I think I was always trying to live up to his standard. So I enjoyed all this.
You enjoyed drill. Did you?
Yes.
Did you then, not now, but then, understand the point of it? If you
I don't think I understood the point of it at all. It was just something you did and a form of useful discipline. I certainly, there were things that you enjoyed, but at the same time they were an awful sweat and an awful waste of time in a sense, or an awful nuisance, but you did them happily because you had to. I mean, I'd much rather have been, instead of being on parade, I'd much rather have been practicing my flute, because I was extremely musical and I was unique.
I'll come to the
yes,
music.
Okay.
Now, so you do the drill. Now, any other forms of training? I mean, weapons training. I mean,
yes, we certainly did weapon training.
Which weapons?
With a SMLE, shortly Enfield rifle.
Now, how did they take you through rifle training? Because I mean, not just obviously drilling with it, but what about actually learning to fire it? I'm meaning now.
I'm not. The only way in which we fired was. On the miniature rifle range.
A .22 range.
.22 range, yes.
Now, were the SMLEs bored out?
I think they must
have
been.
Were they adapted to be
.22? You know, I simply can't remember now, but I think they were the ordinary rifle, probably with a specially bored barrel. You could do. You were taken to the range as part of the training on certain days and certain times, but also it was a voluntary occupation as a form of sport. I mean, some people gave their lives to the miniature range and shot for the school and that sort of thing.
Now, were you a reasonably decent shot?
Yes, I think I hit the target usually, but I always tended to find the rifle pretty heavy, so that I would. And if you didn't shoot quickly, it began to wave about, you know. the other thing, of course, that we did was, naming of parts, it was called. You dismantled your rifle, you took out the bolt. And I suppose we also had machine guns, what were they called? Not before Bren guns.
Lewis.
Lewis guns, that's
now
right.
Now tell me about the Lewis guns. That's the one with the round magazine.
That's right, yes. I'm best not to tell you much about it. I think it stood on a little tripod. And it had a cooling system or something. It was very fat, I mean, round the barrel.
It depends. If it had a round barrel, it's a Lewis. If it had a fed-in tape of bullets, it's a Vickers. It's much bigger.
Oh, it wasn't a Vickers, no. It's definitely a Lewis gun. Sure of
it
that.
It does have cooling around the normal one. Yeah, it's air cooling.
That's what it was, yes.
What did you think of the Lewis? I mean, you wouldn't get a chance to fire that, I presume.
I don't think so.
Were you just taking it apart then?
Yes. Now, I must confess that I get rather confused between my army service and my OTC service in this sort of thing, because I did it all again as a recruit in the army. But I should say that that's about all we did, marching.
What about bayonet training? Running at Saxon?
We fixed bayonets. I don't think we ran at Saxon. I certainly did that as an army recruit. I can't remember doing it at Harrow.
Did you have any exercises that's the weapons side of training, and it's quite that sounds about right actually. What about what they call tactical exercises? Normally it's just charging about, pretending to attack things or defend things.
Now of course we had a field day in which we were taken out at various places. Most common was usual was Berkhamsted Common.
Now what would a field day be like on Berkhamsted Common?
We went in motor coaches or something, and we were formed up into rival armies, as far as I remember. And we worked our way forward and met the enemy. And exactly what happened now, I can't remember, because we couldn't shoot at one another. It is strange, you know. I simply can't remember.
So they were just tactical exercises, but you don't remember much about
yes.
them. Did you have an annual camp?
We had an annual camp. Yes, and I went to one only, and that was at Tidworth Common, 1935.
Now, why only one?
Because getting a senior in the school quickly, I began to get options of doing other things, and as soon as I got my Certificate A, which was the general test for all that you've been taught, I was allowed to resign from the, and I did. And I joined the Boy Scouts.
I'll come back to that. So what did you do at Tidworth Common that one year you went?
I can only remember going on a very hot day, going on a route march with a water bottle at my side, and there was a tremendous downpour, a thunderstorm, and we all got absolutely soaked to the skin. Came back, marched back in the blazing sunshine again, steaming. And I don't think anybody was the worse for it, but it was a strange experience. We all had to get out of our uniforms and change.
Were you living in tents?
We were living in tents, yes. And
were there other public schools present?
Oh, yes. I remember vividly, of course, things that are irrelevant now, the railway journey from Harrow to Tidworth and things like that, which were... my other great interest was railways, of course. Eventually we were in lines of tents of Tidworth, and each school put its name on a little peg and a little notice at the end of its lines. And we were strictly kept within bounds in the evenings, but we found a hole in the hedge, and we used to go out and go and drink in a pub called The Boot at Shipton Billinger.
Now, you were only 15 then.
Yes.
So that's pretty young.
I remember drinking cider, and it was very strong, very pale coloured, and very intoxicating. I remember precious little about what we did in the military world at all. I can remember chaplain. There was a drill hall or something in which entertainments took place, and we all went in the evening. And this unfortunate man tried to mimic the great singer of the day, Bing Crosby, and called him Krong Bisbee or something silly, you know. We were all terribly bored, and he was called Hughes, Padre Hughes, who became a bishop in the end or something, but